Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush says he has a plan to deal with the impact of Hurricanes Rita and Katrina on the cost of gas and electricity. We'll have more on that in a moment, but first, a look at how the Gulf Coast is rebounding from the storms today. The 3 million people who evacuated the Gulf region in advance of Rita are returning to their homes in Texas and Louisiana, and they're finding the drive a lot smoother than the one they faced when evacuating Houston and Point South last week. In New Orleans, Mayor Ray Nagin is allowing residents of the Algiers section of that town to come home. They say they will have electricity, water, and sewer services. But along the coast of Louisiana, people are facing the most extensive damage. Search and rescue operations have been completed, but thousands of people are now in shelters with their homes along the coast completely underwater. Here's Audrey Thibodeau. She works for the sheriff's office in Iberia Parish. Her thoughts on the towns that have been submerged.
It's just a terrible thing. I mean, you can well imagine that life as the people know it has totally changed. And it's, where do you go? Unlike New Orleans, where the people had to evacuate and move to a strange place, they were evacuating into their parish, into safer places, and they have relatives, I'm sure, that they can count on. So it's a different, but still in all, when you've lost, you know, everything, your home, some people, vehicles, and of course, if the whole town is submerged, anybody who was employed there has lost their job, mm-hmm. at least for the time being. Yeah. You know, it's very traumatic for them. I mean,
so when people say that Hurricane Rita really didn't have any punch, you would disagree?
Oh, definitely. I think you know, it maybe wasn't Katrina. Certainly displaced and damaged a lot more. I mean, a whole city, but if it damages your world, no matter how small it is, it's tragic. And I guess if you're looking on from another area, you may dismiss it. But certainly if you're feeling the impact, you are not dismissing it. Mm. Your whole life has changed, you know.
That's Audrey Thibodeau of the Emergency Management Preparedness in Iberia Parish, Louisiana. And we turn now to Keith O'Brien, who's been reporting for the Boston Globe from that region. He joins us now. And Keith, I know you're in that coastal area in Louisiana. How bad is it?
Well, Robin, it is mostly covered in water. Homes everywhere south of Highway 14 have taken on a good bit of water, as much as 8 to 10 feet. This storm brought a storm surge of 9 to 12 feet, and we're talking about a wall of water that just came right out of the Gulf and into their homes.
And 30 miles in some places. You spent the weekend working with some of the local people who got together boats and were rescuing people. What did you see?
Well, on Saturday, in the hours after the storm, people were launching boats from a train track in Vermilion Parish. These were private boats. These were local people with skiffs and whatever kind of runabout they could get into the water. And the winds were still high at that point, Robin, 50 miles an hour at gusts. And they were going out into whitecap waters that used to be roads and sugarcane fields and pulling people and whatever they could out of homes down there.
How surprising was this to these people? Because, as you write, they've been through other storms.
It was shocking to them, actually. They live about 100 miles east of Cameron Parish, which was the far southwestern parish in Louisiana that got a piece of the eye wall from Rita. They were not expecting this kind of flood. And these are people who are used to water, who live off the water, make a living off of it, and have spent their whole lives living near it, and it did take them by surprise.
Right. And we understand that you're now back in Baton Rouge, but you almost got stuck on your return trip in those flooded areas. What happened?
It's true. On Saturday, as I launched with a boat of two guys who lived in Maurice, Louisiana, the floodwaters were coming up Highway 14 at that point, and a lot of boaters who had been there were abandoning the operation, but I wanted to go in and see what there was to see. By the time I got back to my SUV on Highway 14 at about 3 o'clock on Saturday, the water had come up, and the east and westerly routes out were blocked. There was at that point only one way out, and it was closing fast, and a sheriff's deputy drove by and said, "That's your only chance, and you better go fast." And fortunately, for making deadline, I did get out. My life was never in any danger, of course.
Well, Keith O'Brien, again, back in Baton Rouge, But it seems as if Louisiana has just been hammered. What's the sense there?
People are weary. People are tired. I was in Baton Rouge this morning talking with a friend of mine who's evacuated from New Orleans, and yesterday she was just trying to find something to do to spend her day, and everything was closed. And she just looked at me and said, "When are our lives going to be back to normal?" And it's a real interesting question, Robin. I don't think anybody knows the answer. I think it's going to be a real long time.
Yeah. Keith O'Brien, reporting for the Boston Globe in the Gulf Coast region. I spent some time in the flooded coast of Louisiana this past week. And Keith, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And now, a message from ExxonMobil. The oil giant has taken out a full-page ad saying, essentially, drive your car less. And President Bush, speaking at the Energy Department today, took up that same message.
I mean, people just need to recognize that these storms have caused disruption, and that if they're able to maybe not drive when they on a trip that's not essential, that would be helpful.
The president also said he'll tap the nation's strategic oil reserve and waive environmental requirements to make up for any shortfalls caused by Hurricanes Rita and Katrina. Well, we'll have analysis of the president's remarks later in the program, but first we turn our attention back to that full-page ad from ExxonMobil. Amy Jaffe is a research fellow at Rice University in Houston. She studies the energy industry. Usually she's based in Houston, but in fact not today. Amy, where are you?
I'm joining you from Denver, in fact.
As an evacuee in a hotel room there?
As an evacuee in a hotel room.
With pets and child.
With three dogs and three children.
Well, thanks so much for giving us your time, because we do want to ask you, well, first of all, about this ad from ExxonMobil, calling on motorists to use fuel wisely. Could you interpret for us some of the things Exxon says? We understand save fuel by reducing trips. They also say defer discretionary purchases to ease supply pressures. I read that to mean don't buy things because it costs a lot to send them to you. But what does that mean?
I think probably what the company was shooting for and what we as Americans need to consider is we're having this very temporary dislocation in our fuel distribution system. You have to consider the fact that 2 to 3 million people had to drive away from Houston, are going to have to drive back to Houston. That creates something like 1 billion gallons of, or 2 billion gallons of extra gasoline demand that we weren't expecting at a time when several of the nation's refineries are down and unable to produce gasoline. So to manage that, we don't want everybody to run out and fill up their tank because that creates extra unnecessary demand and strain on the system. What we need people to do is to be careful in their use of gasoline. So what does that mean? That means that of course, I have to use my car to get back and forth from work and to get to my kids to school and to extra activities and to the store. What I shouldn't be doing is taking the car this weekend to drive all the way up to Maine to see the foliage.
To see foliage anywhere in the country. And I'm just wondering, that how's that going to resonate with the tourist industry?
Well, I mean, it is a problem for the tourist industry, but we're not talking about forever. We're just talking about the next few days. I mean, the idea is to really try to think conservatively about what do I need to do with my car and what might I be able to do at relatively low inconvenience to myself. If you've already planned a holiday, of course you should go on your holiday.
But Amy Jaffe, I can see people opening up this huge full-page ad and thinking, where have you been, ExxonMobil? You know, energy conservation is something that people have been pushing for years, and some activists and consumers are interested in it for more than just a few days. Is this too little, too late?
Well, I have to say, I think the oil industry and the car industry in the United States have been very slow to respond to this kind of eventuality. We had a task force in 2000 at the James Baker Institute at Rice University, and we recommended and highlighted the fact that we were going to be in increasing problems because of the limitations on the supply chain. We haven't added any refineries in the United States. There has been very little expansion in the refining industry abroad, and therefore we showed that there are shortages gasoline manufacturing capability, pipeline moving capability, and even oil production capability all around the world. And we warned that this kind of problem would emerge.
Well, it seems that consumers are ahead of the industry because we're seeing the sales of SUVs, for instance, falling 12%. And we're also seeing today the CEO of Ford, William Clay Ford, the junior, sending a letter to President Bush asking for an energy summit and asking for the government to give some help to the auto industry to find alternative fuel resources. Again, a consumer might say a little late.
Totally late. I mean, for Ford Motor Company to stand up now is outrageous. They lobbied against CAFE standards. They lobbied against changing technologies. They have tried to push out policies that would have propelled hybrid cars and other alternative technologies into our marketplace 4 years ago. For years, they've been opposing this, saying that it would cost American jobs. Well, the answer is because Americans are no longer going to buy SUVs and because there are foreign car companies that are going to offer better automobiles that get better gasoline mileage than our own American companies, American workers will suffer, but they'll suffer because the leadership in our car companies was very behind the curve in terms of bringing better products to market that got better gasoline mileage. And they convinced everybody that we should all be driving a Hummer for safety reasons when they sell products like the Dodge Neon and the Ford Escort and those cars. People do not have to be afraid to be driving in a small car like that.
Well, Amy Jaffe, how afraid should we all be of gas prices? Because of the 1-2 punch of Katrina and Rita, how thin is the ice on which the energy industry and American consumers are walking right now?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors that are going to influence prices over time. I mean, one, of course, is going to be consumer preferences. If people say, well, I'm not going to be inconvenienced, I'm going to use my car to do everything the same as usual, then there'll be some pressure on gasoline prices and they will go up. In addition, we have to worry about events in foreign marketplaces. If there's a terrorist attack abroad or a labor strike in Nigeria or we get additional storms in the U.S. Gulf Coast, then we're going to continue to see disruptions that are going to move the price of oil around, and those are going to affect us at the pump.
There's no wiggle room.
We have no wiggle room. We have no extra inventories. We just have the emergency stockpiling system that the U.S. government participates in together with Europe and Japan and South Korea. That's our only padding to help us weather these disruptions. And so, therefore, any change in supply that comes about as factors outside of our control, whether that's weather or politics abroad, is going to affect how much we pay at the pump.
Amy Jaffe is a research fellow in energy at Rice University in Houston, although she's evacuated Houston and is speaking to us from Colorado. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, we'll have more on the president's plan post-Katrina and Rita. And later in the program, prosecutors in Spain had hoped an al-Qaeda suspect would be sentenced to 75,000 years in jail for his role in the 9/11 attacks. Today, he was sentenced to just 27 years. We'll see why prosecutors got less than they wanted and how hard it is to take al-Qaeda to court. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been taking a look at the effect of the recent hurricanes on the economy. We've also been looking at what seems to be a shifting of gears on the part of the Bush White House and major automakers. Today, President Bush spoke at the Energy Department, saying he'll consider using strategic oil reserves to stabilize prices and urging consumers to conserve energy and avoid unnecessary travel. Well, Michael Mandel is a reporter with Business Week magazine. He joins us from his office in New York. And Michael, first of all, what do you think of the president's remarks?
Well, I thought it was interesting that he talked about tapping into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, because in the past the government has not really been willing to do that to keep prices stable. But he's making a really what is a political point, a political judgment that that he doesn't want gas prices to go up that high.
Well, and he also, in sync with ExxonMobil's newspaper ads, which we mentioned earlier, these big ads asking people not to drive. He also is calling on consumers not to drive, which does seem like a message that's very different from the one this administration has been sending out. We go back to 2001. You might remember when Vice President Dick Cheney was thought to have said something negative about conservation. And when Ari Fleischer, the president's press secretary, was asked about it, here's his quote. He said about conservation, "That's a big no. The president believes that's an American way of life. The American way of life is a blessed one, and we have a bounty of resources in this country." So this was a White House that really resisted the idea of conserving.
He's also taking action to keep prices down. The easiest way to have people conserve is to have higher gas prices and have higher oil prices. And when you have that, people get into a different mindset and they say, "Okay, things are more expensive. I'm going to change what I'm buying. I'm going to change the way that I'm living." If he sends this message that the government is going to do things to keep prices down, that sends a different message. I tend to view both the oil company ads and a lot of what Bush said today with a little bit of cynicism, because here we are, we have tight supplies. Now you're talking about conservation? It's kind of a bizarre thing to be doing.
Well, you know, and some would wonder too how part of his core constituency is reacting to this. You know, big business. I'm thinking of Walmart, which has been taking a hit in recent times because of gas prices, because a lot of people aren't getting in their cars to drive out to the big superstores as they did in the past.
I think that you have to take a step back and look at this in the larger picture. The U.S. is addicted to petroleum in part because we don't have any good alternatives. And one of the things that successive administrations have done, not just the Bush administration, but both Democrats and Republicans, is they've cut the government research budget for new energy sources. And part of the reason why we're in this position is because we've really slacked off on the development of new stuff. Remember, the hybrids, which everybody has been talking about, came out of Japan. So a lot of other countries have been doing a lot more than we have in terms of the research.
I think
that's really the most important point.
Well, and what do you think should happen now? I mean, as we said, car companies such as Ford and Toyota are now lobbying Washington, Ford calling for a big summit and looking for help with alternative fuels. What do you think should happen now?
Right now, at this point, the best thing to happen, and this is where I put a little bit of my hard-hatted economics thinking on, is that the easiest way to get people to conserve is for prices to go up and to stay up a bit. And then what happens is people decide what's worth it to them and what isn't.
Do you think this administration will do that, put a tax on gas, for instance, or raise the price?
No, this administration will never put a tax on gas. And I wasn't actually suggesting putting a tax on gas. Right now, I think the president's message would have been better if he hadn't sort of made the point about keeping gas prices down by releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I think right at this point, the best message that I've sent to people is, you know, we've moved into a new era where things are going to be more expensive in terms of energy. You need to think about what's important to you. Maybe not this week, maybe not next week, but in terms of your next set of purchases. I'm a little bit wary about the car companies in terms of whether or not they've genuinely moved over to a new position. It is true, however, that Ford has been a more environmentally minded company than some of the others.
Well, you say you're wary. I'm looking at my Wall Street Journal in a headline that says Chrysler bets on SUVs. They're coming out with brand new line of SUVs.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? What you really want, I think in the end, is that if people think that $3 a gallon gas is going to be temporary and it's going to be back down to $1.50, they're not going to really change what they buy. If, in fact, they think it's going to be permanent or if they think it's going to stay high, then you'll see some much bigger changes.
Well, Mike Mandel, in the couple minutes we have, what do you think of the broader impact of not just the worries about gas prices, but the potential $200 billion price tag in the wake of Katrina? Where do you see, I mean, here we have a president, he may be winking, I think that's maybe not winking, but maybe sending mixed messages, telling people not to go shop. But I think if people take those extra trips, don't take those extra trips, don't shop, don't go and be leaf peepers, that's going to trickle down into the economy.
Yeah, that could have a much bigger effect than the higher gas prices could. It's kind of interesting. I'm not really at this point. I think you're looking at an economy which is still fairly strong, with the impact, though devastating, of the hurricanes is still fairly local. I would if I was him, I wouldn't be telling people not to go shop.
And what do you think, you know, again, with that $200 billion price tag, we've been speaking about how this is sort of racking the Republican Party within the party. There's a lot of disagreement about this. Do you think that there will be budget cuts? Do you think there will be?
No, I don't think there's going to be budget cuts. I don't think there's going to be a big economic impact. What will have a big impact is this is setting a precedent for the future. The combination of what happened in New York after the terrorist attacks, what happened in the Gulf Coast after the hurricanes. Anytime there's going to be a natural disaster from now on, or natural or a big disaster of any type, the precedent has been set that the federal government will pay out a large sum of money, and that is something new.
Mike Mandel, reporter for Business Week in New York City, taking a look at the economic landscape in the wake of Katrina and now Rita. Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, is there a formula for stage-to-screen adaptations? We're going to take a look at Proof, for either Proof or not. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Debemos condenar y condenamos como autores de un delito de pertenencia o integración. A Spanish court has found 18 suspects linked to the 9/11 attacks guilty in the largest trial of al-Qaeda suspects in Europe. But the alleged ringleader, a Syrian-born Spaniard, was sentenced to only 27 years in prison, not the nearly 75,000 years, or 25 years for each 9/11 victim, that prosecutors had requested. Well, joining us first on the line from Madrid is Financial Times correspondent Leslie Crawford. And Leslie, who is this ringleader? Why did he get such a relatively light sentence?
I think it was because prosecutors couldn't pin down his direct involvement in organizing or planning the September 11th attacks. We know that Mohamed Atta, one of the suicide pilots, did visit Spain the months before the 9/11 attacks, but I don't think prosecutors could pin down that Imad-ed-Din Barakat, the leader of the al-Qaeda cell in Spain, actually had anything to do with the planning of those attacks, and therefore he was cleared of the murder of the 9/11 victims.
So what was he sentenced for?
Well, he was sentenced for organizing an al-Qaeda cell in Spain and of providing finance and of recruiting jihadist militants to go and fight various wars in Chechnya, Bosnia, Afghanistan, etc.
Well, tell us about some of the other lesser-known men who were also on trial. What were they accused of?
Well, three of them were accused of being leaders of these cells, and others were just accused of collaborating with al-Qaeda or collaborating with this Spanish cell. And of course, for me, the most controversial accusations were against Taysir Alouni, the Al Jazeera correspondent.
Mm. Well, and tell us about that. Taysir Alouni, again, one of the suspects. Others have said he's a respected journalist. What was his sentence for what crime?
Well, Taysir Alouni was the Al Jazeera's correspondent in Kabul at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and he was the first correspondent to interview Osama bin Laden after those attacks. And he was arrested in Spain and charged with collaborating with al-Qaeda.
What was the proof of that?
Well, apparently he had taken money from Spain to Afghanistan to a family of Syrian exiles. And the prosecutor claimed that he was financing al-Qaeda. And Taysir says that he just took this money out of, you know, compassionate reasons, and that in no way was this family involved in terrorist activities.
And we should say Al Jazeera, the network, is saying it will appeal Alouni's seven-year sentence. Leslie Crawford, a correspondent for the Financial Times based in Madrid. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, we turn now to Newsweek correspondent Christopher Dickey, who is based in Paris. He wrote an article recently, by the way, entitled The Suicide Solution. It's about what motivates suicide bombers. We want to get his thoughts on that, but also on the recent sentencing. Welcome, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure, Robin.
And what is your reaction to these verdicts out of Spain, especially the sentencing of Al Jazeera journalist Taser Aluni? You knew him, didn't you?
Yes, I knew him, and I knew him in a specific context. In early 2001, I was trying to get an interview with Osama bin Laden, and he was the man that I contacted who seemed to be somebody who could put it all together. It didn't fall into place before September 11th, and of course after that there was no question. Mm-hmm. But there's no question either that Taser Aluni had very, very good lines into al-Qaeda and to Osama bin Laden himself. And that raises a lot of questions. If a journalist has contacts like that, does that make him a co-conspirator? I don't know. It seems that the Spanish court determined that they thought it did, but I'm not sure that we would want to see that precedent stand over the long term.
Was he respected as a journalist?
Yes, he was. I mean, he was a pretty straight journalist. You know, Al Jazeera is a television station that's had a lot of controversy because it gives a point of view that's very, very different from the American network point of view. But it gives a point of view that in the Arab world, in the Arab and Muslim context, is often very balanced and fair. And I think that he was pretty much in that mold.
Well, we want to speak to you as well about your recent article. You wrote about what might motivate suicide bombers, and you wrote of something called suicide contagion. What do you mean by that?
It's really a long established pattern that people understand very well, sociologists understand very well, and psychologists do, in all kinds of societies, including Western societies, that when you break the taboo that says you don't kill yourself in a certain segment of society, you can have a contagion where several people will all of a sudden decide that that's the way they want to end their lives. And so you'll have outbreaks. You'll have, like, sort of small epidemics of suicide in, say, American high schools. And what you've seen, if you want to move into the question of suicide bombing, what you've seen over the last 20, 25 years is a concerted effort by various groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, to break down those barriers in Arab and Muslim society, which are quite strong barriers, as a matter of fact, and say that suicide is martyrdom. It's okay. You should do it. It's your ticket to heaven. And they have helped consciously to create a kind of a contagion of suicide, suicidal terrorism in those societies.
Well, you quote University of Chicago political scientist Robert Pape, who we've also had on this program. He wrote a book about suicide bombers, and his claim is that they are motivated by a rage against foreign occupation. Are you saying that it might be that, but in addition, there's this, as you said, contagion that...
I think it's gone beyond that now. What you had was a situation where occupation started the ball rolling. And now within the particular Muslim context, you have al-Qaeda especially, but other groups, preaching the idea that the Muslim world as a whole is under occupation, that the ummah, the great Muslim community of believers, is under occupation and under threat. And that is a conscious effort to extend not only the jihad, but the extent of what they call martyrdom operations, which in fact is suicide terrorism. Mm. And I think we may be beyond the point, or very close to it, where ending the various occupations, the occupation of Palestinian territory, the occupation of Iraq, and so on, where that would end the problem.
Christopher Dickey, he's a correspondent for Newsweek magazine based in Paris. And by the way, to read more of Christopher's thoughts on these and other topics, you can go to his blog, The Shadowland Journal, by going to our website, here-now.org. And as always, you can send your thoughts on our program to us. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, Bob Dylan, according to Martin Scorsese. You're listening to Here and Now. How to Improve Education. Everyone, it seems, has an idea, and now we hear from director David Lynch. He's best known for his films, including Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, and Mulholland Drive, but David is also a devotee of transcendental meditation, and he's launched a foundation to promote bringing TM to schools. He's making his pitch for what he calls consciousness-based education on college campuses this fall, starting at Emerson College here in Boston this Saturday. He also plans to visit Yale, Brown, and New York University. Well, we recently spoke to David about this new project and asked him how meditation had affected his life.
Before, I was interested in it, I thought meditation was a waste of time. And I couldn't believe anybody would sit there, you know, either not cross-legged or cross-legged and close their eyes, and I didn't realize, you know, or care what they were doing. And then it struck me that phrases like true happiness isn't out there, true happiness lies within, there is some within. And where is this within, and how do you get there, and is it real? And it struck me that meditation was the way to go within. And I started transcendental meditation in 1973 during Eraserhead, and I've been doing it twice a day ever since.
You've written that it took away a lot of anger that you had, free-floating anger.
Negativity runs away, and positive values grow. And you experience subtler levels of mind, subtler levels of intellect, and you transcend and experience the unified field within, pure consciousness. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing lying within, right there for everyone.
Well, now, and you want to bring this thing to schools. Why? Why schools? Why kids?
If you saw the way the kids change with this consciousness-based education, where the student learns, knows himself or herself by diving within, knowledge is then seen in terms of the self. And the student, negativity starts fleeing away, all these learning, you know, disorders, all this stress, anxiety, fears, angers, they just start evaporating.
David, I just want to hold you up for a second, because I can hear parents saying, wait a minute, TM, isn't that the long-haired cult? So let's just take a second and address some of the critics. I know you've heard them. Stephen Hassan, who's a well-known cult deprogrammer, he writes that TMers who pay a small fee and get their mantra and practice 15 minutes a day, he has no concerns. But he says there are core followers who believe that their master is the only enlightened being on earth. That is mind control. He's had to deprogram some. And John Knapp, a former leader of TM, he was a governor of the Age of Enlightenment, agrees with Stephen. So this is mind control?
No, it's not. It's just unfolding the potential of a human being.
But, you know, if it's not mind control in your view, is it a religion? And
it's not a religion. People from every religion do practice transcendental meditation and can. And one of the things I loved about transcendental meditation is you don't have to, you know, do anything after you learn how to meditate. You just go about your life and add that to it twice a day and watch things improve. Mm. The doing of things gets so much more fun. Ideas flow. Happiness starts growing inside. Every day becomes like a Saturday morning instead of a hellish Thursday morning when you're late for work.
Well, now I want to ask you, I can just hear your many film fans saying, well, good for you, David Lynch, that you have this peace and light, but you made a wreck out of me with one of your films or television shows, because while they are described as beautiful and mesmerizing often, they're all, you know, I see the word strange a lot, you know this, and there's something dark about them as well. So obviously TM isn't about anesthetizing yourself to darker feelings.
No, no. A film, a book, a story has contrast. Huge contrasts are fantastic in the stories. They can all be about suffering. They can be about the human condition. But you don't have to suffer in your life to do those films. It's not that you become a goody-goody two-shoes. You become more yourself.
Well, now, and you'd like to introduce it now into schools. And
I'd like to introduce it to schools that want it. When they learn about it and hear about it and ask questions and get answers and they say, we want it, I'd like to be able to get it to them.
David Lynch, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
That's filmmaker David Lynch. Now, for more on his project to get TM into schools, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. I was born very far from where I'm supposed to be. So Bob Dylan says at the start of No Direction Home, the new documentary of Dylan's early years from director Martin Scorsese, airing tonight and tomorrow on PBS stations and already available on DVD. In No Direction Home, Scorsese provides a roadmap from Dylan's Midwestern hometown through his rejection of the folk icon Crown. Dylan himself narrates the story as he did in his best-selling Chronicles memoir. So some critics have asked, how critical can the film be? Well, we asked Here Now pop and rock critic and author Tim Riley for his impressions.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways.
Folky, politico, rock and roller, country rocker, country crooner, Bible thumper, and rock's reigning curmudgeon, Bob Dylan now plunges into his latest persona, librarian. But if the hat trick of his Chronicles memoir was skipping the 1960s entirely, here is our compensation. Scorsese gives previously unreleased Dylan music a beguiling visual track with home movies and well-chosen newsreels to turn the tired biographical genre into compelling narrative. Aesthetically, it tracks Dylan from 1961 to 1966, from fawning hick to artistic supernova. No Direction Home begins with footage of Hibbing, Minnesota, the mining town where Dylan's father and uncle ran an electrical store. Dylan is candid about the bleak surroundings he grew up in.
The sound of the record made me feel like I was somebody else than, you know, that I was maybe not even born to the right parents or something.
Through an early glimpse of Dylan performing at high school, released here for the first time, it's clear much of the town felt the same way.
I saw Robert stand there at the piano, and my guess is that he was trying to destroy it. He pounded on the thing. The principal pulled the curtain on him. He said to me, I didn't think that music was suitable for the audience, so I pulled the curtain.
For a long time, Dylan has been either reserved or fanciful about his background. In the beginning, he just made up a lot of stories. So it's a little odd seeing him talk to the camera as a 64-year-old man, reflecting on how impressionable he once was, and what a huge impact Woody Guthrie had on his adolescence. Scorsese trumps any number of Dylan scholars with revealing comparisons. There's a knowing transition between Guthrie singing his song 1913 Massacre and Dylan's own Song to Woody. Dylan based his tribute squarely on Guthrie's melody, and the symmetry between these songs is now undeniable.
Take a trip with me in 1913. To Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country.
Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along.
But Scorsese also digs beyond obvious influences. Dylan mentions a singer named John Jacob Niles. This gentle old man leaps into falsetto while strumming his auto harp. You can imagine a Jewish kid from Minnesota listening in and realizing that his own strangeness might actually be an asset.
Go away from my window, go away from my door, go away, away, away from my picture, and go over me no more.
We know Dylan is not the most reliable narrator. That's part of what makes him hugely entertaining. He's never been more sincere retelling his life for the camera, but there's still a sly undertow to almost everything he says. It's like he knows there's no such thing as a last word, no such thing as definitive. The cast of talking heads Scorsese gathers around him includes mainstays of the Greenwich Village folk crowd who were close to him, many of whom are not even on speaking terms anymore. Dave Von Ronk tells a story about Dylan stealing his arrangement of House of the Rising Sun on his debut album, before Von Ronk even had a chance to record it. Dylan asked his permission after the session.
He asked me if I would mind if he recorded my version of House of the Rising Sun. And I had some plans to record it. So I said, well, gee, Bob, I'd rather you didn't, because I'm going to record it myself soon. And Bobby said, uh-oh.
Then there's some well-chosen quotes from beat poet Allen Ginsberg and folk holdout Pete Seeger, who admired Dylan's topical songs but not his electric break. Scorsese gets them to talk frankly about Dylan's young promise and powerhouse ambition to give the film a bracing candor. It's among the frankest, least sentimental of rock documentaries. Even Dylan's early girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, last seen on the cover of 1963's Freewheelin', joins the conversation. Scorsese's biggest plum is having Joan Baez reminisce about their relationship, both personal and professional, which fell apart as Dylan's star exploded in 1965, just as hers began to plummet. For Baez, Dylan was as difficult a personality as he was mercurial a songwriter, and there's as much affection in her comments as regret.
He would always say, what do you think of this? And I wouldn't understand the thing at all, but I loved it. So I went, well, okay, I'm going to figure this one out. So I read through it, and I gave back my interpretation of what I thought it was about. He said, oh, that's pretty f***ing good. You know, I said, so, you know, a bunch of years from now, all these people, all these assholes are going to be writing about all this shit I write. I don't know where the f*** it comes from. I don't know what the f*** it's about. And they're going to write about what it's about.
Framing the larger narrative are stage clips from Dylan's 1966 tour of England as he lurched into psychedelic rock. Much of this footage was shot for a television special that never aired. But Scorsese recuts this film as the epitome of rock performance. Even today, this music doesn't sound tame or safe or settled in any way. And the energy it sets loose was too far out even for the 1960s audience. Dylan's rising power on the folk scene is intercut with music from the height of his fame, still vaulting way ahead of his listeners, swatting down journalists, and delivering music like scalding hot water on everybody's expectations. This footage has long been rumored to be some of the best rock and roll ever made, and Scorsese finally gives it the frame it deserves. The distance Dylan's muse travels in these first 5 years is breathtaking. And for once, the filmmaker draws the larger cultural context through lovingly preserved musical performances. Footage from another newly released documentary about the 1965 Newport Festival opens a window on liberal culture's greatest hopes. We see the March on Washington, the impact of the Kennedy assassination, and the brazen way Dylan dumps politics and embraces rock and roll. Scorsese draws you back inside the 60s without ever condescending to its flaws or pieties. The result makes for vivid history, with new revelations about an era that's almost a cliché. No Direction Home turns a scraggly old rock and roll librarian into a hero who helped shape his era and then quickly moved on.
Tim Riley, Here and Now's pop and rock critic, also author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary, speaking about the new Bob Dylan documentary, No Direction Home. For more information on the film and for Dylan photos, go to our website, here-now.org. Again, that documentary airing tonight on PBS stations. I guess I know what I'll be doing. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.